If I can draw you and your minds back to last year for a moment, all that time ago, and the series that we then completed just before Advent about spiritual gifts. What we're attempting as we enter into this new series for the new year is to just re-engage ourselves with some of those thoughts that we had from last year, but thinking more about how that looks in the story of God, how we see God at work through his people. And we've chosen a series of characters who, well, in one sense, have this transition from a place of normality, whatever that means, to doing something particular and perhaps even special according to God's call and purpose, because that's part of our journey in the spiritual life, in our spiritual life, isn't it? To understand God's purposes out of our normality into something that's particular and special, to understand the ways which God has called us and rested his presence with us in, for a particular time, for particular situations, and for his blessing. So in recalling our journey through the spiritual gifts last year, I want to remind you that there is still an opportunity to talk to us about some your spiritual gifting. If you remember, if you were around, we did a questionnaire. We invited you to fill out a questionnaire, and I know that 30-something filled out a questionnaire. And we also know that some people struggled to do that for various different reasons or just generally objected. That's fine. But in inviting you to do that, all we wanted is a conversation. We wanted to be able to have a conversation with you. And the hope is that if you didn't know what to put on that questionnaire, the hope is that we could even have a conversation about to help you put something down on paper, just so that we understand you better, so that we can understand your place in God's purposes and help you understand that. So if you're one of those people that's struggling with that, I'm hoping that this series will help you a bit, because that was our ambition as well, but also just to invite you into that conversation with us. That was our ambition. So if we haven't been clear about that, if we've not communicated well enough in that regard, then hopefully those few words help you this morning. But please do talk to us, is what we're asking. So our new series then will hopefully build somewhat on that thinking. We'll be looking at and noting the different ways in which God calls people out into something new and different. And I couldn't help but have the word kairos going on in the back of my thoughts. If you don't know the word kairos, it's the Greek word for God's timing. It's the word that's always used in terms of God having a particular time in which he works out his purposes in his people. So then in terms of zooming in a little bit on Nehemiah, and bearing in mind that there is much that could be said, because I'm only preaching on Nehemiah once, this is not an overview as such, but an observation as to some things that are going on around Nehemiah. I think the thing that is most easily missed as we read these, I think perhaps familiar words from the beginning of Nehemiah, is something about the timing of it all. And we've already mentioned God's timing in it, but there's something here about the best words that I found for it were God's spacious delay. I think we can get lost in the chronology of this, actually, and there's much bickering, and I don't really understand why, but there's a lot of bickering in people that have got big brains and want to write a book and want to sell a book as to the exact chronology of all of this. So giving you a bit of context, you need to understand Nehemiah, first of all, in the context of Ezra. If you're not aware, Ezra and Nehemiah need to be jammed together. And in lots of traditions, they're very much referred to as the same book. They're next to one another in the canon of our Bible, but you need to read them together. They must always be read together to be understood in the context of one another. I would probably say from time to time, rather than I would often call the book Ezra Nehemiah rather than just Nehemiah. And that there's particular timings around all of this. What you need to understand, probably first of all, is that this is about a return from exile. And I think we've talked about that quite a lot recently. We've talked about the context of people in exile and what that means to be dislocated from your homeland and particularly from Jerusalem in this case. And all that that means in terms of your faith, how strong our faith would need to be as people in exile, as people dislocated from the heart of their heritage, I guess. But this is all about the return from exile. And we've got a period really here of about 150 years. We're dealing about 150 years of exile. That this is the timing, this is the place where we're looking here about Ezra, Nehemiah returning back to Jerusalem. But even as we take the timing from the beginning of Ezra, as God's people return, and much of Ezra is about lists, it's sometimes a little difficult to preach Ezra chapter by chapter because there's just an awful lot of lists of people and how they return to Jerusalem, about people coming back in and all those thousands of people that exist there. But it's that return. It's Ezra but even the gap between Ezra and Nehemiah then is about 15 years. So as we read this, we've got to remember that there has been a return to Jerusalem, and all that that means, look, that's a really important and glorious occasion, that highway of God's people back to the promised land. But then we've also got this 15-year period, much of which we read about in the book of Ezra, and then there's some time assumed then towards even the beginning of Nehemiah, that we just know that there's something goes on. But it's 15 years. Now, 15 years is a significant portion of time, isn't it? Years fly by individually, don't they? But 15 years, if we think back to 2005, that feels like a long time ago, doesn't it? So actually, there's something interesting and perhaps even difficult about the beginning, that what's going on here as we go back to the beginning of Nehemiah. Because what's happened in those 15 years? Well, we know some of what's happened. We know that Ezra has tried to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem on a number of occasions, and that actually those have been aborted attempts. That there's been difficulty in that. But actually also remember what it would have felt like for those people who'd received that call to return and then then what they were arriving back to. What would it have felt like? You've been longing to be put back where you belong. You're a people who you know where you belong in the world. And yet when they get back into the promised land, when they get back to the holy city, Jerusalem, and all that that means in terms of their identity, they find ruins, first of all, and they struggle to rebuild. 15 years of that. What would that have felt like for God's people? 15 years of struggle. You've been promised this return, you've been allowed to return, but 15 years of struggle. I think you feel let down, don't you, at that point? This should have been milk and honey again, shouldn't it? Shouldn't this have been about a promise to return to some kind of prosperity, some kind of success, something like that? Shouldn't it have been that? Look, if God has ordained this, then shouldn't this be right? Shouldn't this be good? Shouldn't this be great? Shouldn't this be some great kind of party that we are invited back into? And yet, all around them, their security has been questioned. Their identity, I think, still remains in question because they've written, what's going on with all of this? So many questions for God's people. And then we're invited into the picture of this man, Nehemiah, who's still in Babylon. He's still in Iran. He's in Susa, which is in modern-day Iran. And he's doing what he normally does. There's been a decision at some point on Nehemiah's behalf that he's going to stay behind and carry on with his role as cupbearer to the king. His family have obviously returned to Jerusalem. They've obviously returned to the promised land. And he has made a decision, one would presume, to remain and carry on in his identity, carry on in his occupation, his calling, whatever we might understand it as. I think there's some interesting thoughts actually about Nehemiah's identity in all of that, first of all. I think it's helpful to unpack maybe some thoughts about that. And I think there are some assumptions that we can make, but bear in mind that they're assumptions rather than that anything is written here. First of all, what does it mean to be a cupbearer to the king? Well, a cupbearer is somebody who dishes out wine. That sounds okay, doesn't it? To select the wine for the king to keep him happy in all sorts of different ways to make sure that that's pleasing before the king. But also there's that sense of hospitality. This is Nehemiah making sure that the king and his guests are looked after in that way. I think wrongly, there's some translations where you would see the word butler put into here. I think you need to increase your understanding of what it means to be a cupbearer to the king, because it's not only about the wine, it's thought. It's rather more about somebody who serves alongside the king and has earned his trust, first of all, because if you're giving the king liquids, then he's trusting you that it's not poisoned and various things like that. But it's also about a position of wisdom, that actually we make the assumption that here that Nehemiah has earned his place in the court. And the thought is that a cupbearer would often be one who was acted more like a steward to the king, that he would perhaps even be the one that guards the king's presence, in meaning that, you know, maybe that he would be the one that sort of filters out those people that the king should see, those people that the king shouldn't see, those kind of things. That this is a position of trust. But what we can also assume in that is that Nehemiah's had a journey in this. We're not given particularly any sense as to how old Nehemiah is, but I think we can assume that Nehemiah was likely to have been born into some of this context. That he probably started as a menial little lad fetching things for other people, that he's had opportunity to grow, that gradually he's been trusted into that role, and he's been trusted into that place of understanding. For Nehemiah, this is his normal life. He's been around this court probably the entirety of his life. Probably. He's grown up, he understands this context. He understands what he is to do, that this is completely normal for him. He's done nothing else in his life up to this point. Let's just press pause there for a minute and think about the ways our normality, that we do so many different things that we regard as normal and just average, don't we? That actually we have that sense of, look, we've done this forever. This is who we are, that there's nothing particularly special about this. It's just what we do. Okay, I'll unpause myself again now. So having that sense as to who Nehemiah is, actually there's no great drama even as we're then told what happens next. All that happens is that Nehemiah's brother visits, Hanani. He appears in our story. Nehemiah is presumably offering up hospitality, maybe even in his own home, to his brother and the men that have come with him. And it's a natural conversation. So, brother, what's going on? What's happening? Tell me all about it, because bear in mind that communication isn't as easy in those days. That this is Nehemiah catching up. It could also be, perhaps, that maybe Hanani and all of these other men, depending on Hanani's importance, again, we don't know, maybe this is an appointment. Maybe this is Nehemiah filtering, like, I need to understand that. Maybe this is an official role. He's got to understand. I think you can take it both ways, actually. But whatever happens, it's not of any great drama. This isn't Hanani coming in and screaming desperation. This is Hanani talking to his brother and Nehemiah asking him questions. What's going on in Jerusalem? What's going on for God's people in this place? They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province and are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken and its gates have been burned with fire. We're not told that he says much more than that. Maybe he didn't say any more than that. But then it's about Nehemiah's response, isn't it? And again, I think that there's something incredibly normal about Nehemiah's response to this. He has that sense of, look, I've chosen to stay in Babylon, but I believe that the glory of God is going to happen by God's people returning to Jerusalem. He knows that story. He knows that that's the great thing that God must be doing by returning his people there. And so look at what stirred up then inside Nehemiah. Mourning. Sadness, pain. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. This is affected. He's trying to understand what God is doing at this time. He's trying to hear God's voice in fasting and praying. He's discerning what God would do in this situation, what his role is in this situation. But notice that first of all, his response is one of deep faith. That it's both of the emotions of the situation that he's stirred up, but it's also about these words of faith, that he's stirred in some sense to put this before God, to lay all that he is before God. And then I think even in this wonderful prayer that he prays, you see this sense of, first of all, God, it's faith in you. It's my understanding of you. It's my trust in who you are. And you have that sense as to that's what God has given him as he's fasted and prayed before God. Because that's kind of how the prayer has its foundations. Look, God, I trust you for all of this. I know that the exile is because of all that happened, that it was because of wicked hearts, that it was because of my sorry state, that all of this happened, Nehemiah says. I accept that exile was a necessary part of your plan for so that we can come back to something. And Nehemiah accepts all of these things. But then with this kind of little turn in that language of conversation, and it turns to something more practical, doesn't it? It turns out of these words of faith and understanding as to who God is. And I struggle to picture it in any other way other than Nehemiah kind of realizing that actually, well, hold on. I've got a position here. That in all that I have been trained to do, in every way that I have been trusted, in every way that I've just carried on in my normality, that I might have an opportunity here. And that even as you read this, the words of this prayer, there's this kind of turn to something different. Because it then becomes about, well, okay. I've got an opportunity. I have got the ear of the king. He trusts me in this conversation. That I can say something about the plight of God's people in Jerusalem. Something may just happen. And then Nehemiah gets the boldness and courage to be even to be able to say, Lord, give me success in this. Give me favor in this so that something good and positive can and will happen. And we see this transformation first from normality to faith to then building up and having the ambition to say, look, God, I believe that maybe this is something, that there's actually change going to happen here. That there is something other than my normality that needs to happen in this situation. And that takes enormous courage, doesn't it? It takes courage to be able to say, God, I believe you beyond the normality of my current context. Doesn't that take courage? Doesn't that take belief in all who God is and all that he will do in our hearts and minds? But it's all done in the context of humility, isn't it? This isn't about Nehemiah saying, Lord, I believe because of who I am, because actually it's very much about him putting his trust in God. It's about the difference between the ordinary and the extraordinary of God. Nehemiah here has been invited to do something particular, to do something extraordinary, to do something significant for a whole nation or for a kingdom, as we would put it. There's something here about that humility of heart, one that says that if it's your will and your call that you will show me the way forwards and let me find the words to say. It's with the caution in the context of humility that Nehemiah seeks confirmation for his task. Of course, then what we begin to learn is that all this is rather significant for the future of God's people. And that even as Nehemiah seeks by administration and leadership, I think it's interesting actually, isn't it, to stop for a minute, think about those ways in which Nehemiah might have been gifted. We can't say, can we? We can't assume that Nehemiah, but actually I think in terms of that great list of spiritual gifts, how would we say Nehemiah was gifted? Something for you to think about. Something administrative, service, leadership. Was leadership a new thing? I think it's interesting to think about. But I think as we go through this story of Nehemiah, and again we're going much further into the chapters of Nehemiah than we've got time to read or understand at any great depth this morning, I think it's about understanding what God's call was really back to. Because I think, and I wonder perhaps whether God's people had missed the point a little bit. They'd expected this great return to prosperity in terms of returning to Jerusalem. They'd expected this great return in terms of security, in terms of a nation and having a city to build around and having a nation to build up again. They probably got their minds back on this picture of David and this great territory and all that that means in terms of wealth and understanding and power. But I think part of what the book of Nehemiah reveals actually is that there is something deeper, that there is something more important. And that's in terms of the covenant, isn't it? That throughout these books, Ezra and Nehemiah, that we see this journey actually back to the heart of God. This journey about a return to covenant at the heart of the life of God's people. And there's this wonderful moment, which is always the bit where you just stop and understand what's going on, where the covenant, the law, is read again. That it's like life is being spoken out again into God's people. The law revealed once again to the heart of their purposes, to the core of their being, and it's like love just soaking out into God's people again. That sense that there is a real heart, that actually it's not much really to do with a return to a city and walls and all of those kind of things. That actually that's secondary rather than primary in terms of the call to God's people. Yes, of course it's about the rebuilding of the walls and all that that means in terms of people connecting with one another and standing around the walls and being built up in that way. But it's much more about this return to something of heart, something of promise. I wonder how God might use your normality this year to bring change to a kingdom. I wonder. I wonder whether you're prepared for that, for your normality to be disturbed a little or a lot. And if that's true, if God would use you to change a kingdom, to disturb your normality and do something kingdom, I wonder what he would bring you back to. Well, I want to suggest this morning that it comes back to the thought of covenant. This morning we will articulate again in different ways as we share communion with one another the heart of that new covenant. And I confess that God had a word for me as I was preparing. A word in the night, as it happens. And it was all in the nature of what it means to have that covenant. In every covenant, in everything that is good, in everything that is the best of that which life has to offer for us, there is death and life. We know that in the story of the new covenant of Jesus Christ. We know that it's sealed in his blood, that it was from his death that we received the hope of new life. For God loved the world so very much that he sent his only Son, that whoever might believe in him shall not perish but have eternal life. But the word that was given to me, I believe from God, it's for you to weigh, is that we needed to let the last year die in order to let the new year live. And I know that that may go quite deep for some of you, actually. That the last year has been one of, for some of you I know, chaos, disorder, pain, grief. That you've felt dislocated and without hope. That you've just struggled. That you're longing somehow for hope, for something new out of your current normality. And my sense of what God was saying, that you have got to let the past year die in order for there to be hope of new life for this one. We've got reassurance actually from God's word in this regard. What does God say about the promise of every new day? He says, actually, we can let every day die, and that he will give us the promise of new life and new hope each and every morning. So it's not just about the year, but actually it's about every single day. That every day is filled with the promise of new hope, if only we would let the past day die. But again, in that way, I believe that the Lord is asking us, that he's given us that confidence, actually, that reassurance, that if only we would let the last year die, that the new one will be filled with hope. And that's a covenant and a promise that I believe is sealed in Jesus' blood. That it's one that is full of the promise of hope and resurrection. Do you know what? I'm just going to leave you with that word this morning. I can say more, doesn't matter. But I hope that you hear that this morning. I had that sense that it was from God. But let us put to death the former things. And in hope and expectation receive the hope of resurrection and new life. Amen. Let's take some time just to pause.